Chapter 25 Our Russia. Putin did not expect the crisis that exploded before the Olympics in Sochi ended. Even though he might have anticipated it 6 years before, when he warned President George Bush that NATO should not consider Ukraine's membership, even though he had ordered a reorganization of Russia's conventional forces to address the shortcomings exposed by the war in Georgia in 2008. And even though he and his advisers had warily monitored the political convulsions in Kyiv caused by its refusal to embrace the European Union, Putin had not planned to take his country to war. Nor had he prepared the country for it. He did not consult with the country's diplomats or its military commanders, certainly not with its elected legislators, who no longer had any influence over how he governed. On the night of February 18th, the street protests in Kyiv, which had ebbed after Putin's $15 billion bailout of Yanukovych's flailing economy, erupted in an orgy of fire and violence as the riot police tried to clear the streets around Independence Square. By the end of the night, more than 24 people had died, most of them protesters, but some of them police officers. By dawn the next day, there was open warfare in the center of the city, with police and protesters exchanging gunfire. The death toll soon climbed over 100, the worst violence in the city since the Great Patriotic War. The reports that filtered back to Putin in the Kremlin, and thus onto Russia's television networks, portrayed the clashes as an armed insurrection, prodded by American and European diplomats who had not only encouraged the protesters, but even passed out food and cookies. What had begun as largely peaceful demonstrations in favor of the agreement with the European Union had evolved since November into a broader movement to oust Yanukovych's corrupt regime. That there were radical groups in the square, masked gunmen from two fiercely nationalistic groups, Svoboda and Pravi Sektor, convinced Putin that Yanukovych had lost control to the forces of anarchy and fascism. Putin never understood the core grievances that kept the majority of the protesters in the streets during those winter months, the yearning to break the corrupted grip of a rapacious leader, the radicalization that had inevitably arisen when even their most basic demands went unheeded. Putin had thought he could buy off the president and thus the people, as he had succeeded in doing in Russia for 14 years, with economic largesse, dispensed at critical moments. As the writer James Meek wrote when the protests in Kyiv descended into violence that day in February, it is the ideal of a complete cynic, Vladimir Putin, the one ideal a complete cynic can have, that people have no ideals. A troika of European diplomats, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Poland, rushed to Kyiv on February 20th to try to broker an end to the violence around Maidan. Still focused on the Olympics in Sochi, Putin said nothing at first, which left Russia's response confused and contradictory. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, denounced the Europeans' effort as an uninvited mission, even as Yanukovych himself sat down to host the ministers. As they hashed out a political compromise they hoped would end the shooting outside, by holding accelerated presidential elections in 2014, as well as granting amnesty for the protesters, Yanukovych interrupted the talks to telephone Putin, who was then back in Moscow. Despite all his efforts to feign independence, he could make no deal without Putin's approval. He told Putin he would agree to step down for new elections, and that he would order the withdrawal of the riot police from the burning barricades not far from the presidential office. In Putin's mind, that amounted to a humiliating abdication, a dangerous sign of weakness in the face of the mob. "You will have anarchy," Putin claimed he told Yanukovych. "There will be chaos in the capital." Yanukovych accepted the Europeans' compromise anyway, and it was announced at 2 o'clock on the afternoon of February 21st. By that evening, Yanukovych's political allies had begun to abandon him. and his authority over the police and interior troops dissipated amid credible reports that a cache of weapons looted from police stations in western Ukraine was on its way to the capital. After issuing a statement congratulating the women's biathlon relay team for winning the country's first gold medal in Sochi, Yanukovych fled the capital. He flew first to eastern Ukraine and then to Crimea, before finally being secretly conveyed to refuge in southern Russia, in a special operation Putin ordered on February 23rd after meeting all night with his advisors. In Yanukovych's wake, the agreement that had been reached to end the fighting unraveled before it could even go into effect. Ukraine's parliament, with Yanukovych's loyalists having broken with him, promptly voted to impeach Yanukovych in a legally dubious procedure. Deputies then elected a new parliamentary leadership and appointed an interim president until new elections could be held. One of the first acts of the newly reconfigured parliament was to make Ukrainian the official language, reversing an earlier law passed by Yanukovych's government that had recognized Russian as well. The new acting president, Alexander Turchinov, blocked the proposal, but not before it inflamed the ethnic divide in Ukraine, one that had never entirely been bridged in nearly a quarter century of independence. In Moscow, the events in Kiev confirmed Putin's worst fears. What was happening was not a popular uprising against a weak, discredited leader, but a revolution, hijacked by Ukrainian nationalists and radicals he compared to the Nazi stormtrooper Ernst Röhm and supported by the enemies of Russia, the Europeans and the Americans. Putin presided over the closing ceremonies in Sochi on the night of February 23rd, after first laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers in Moscow in the morning. The Olympics not only defied the most dire predictions of disaster, they ended with Russia's athletes winning the most gold medals, 13, and the most medals overall, 33. Now, at Russia's moment of glory, years in the making, the convulsions in Ukraine overshadowed everything. That a 16-day sporting event had taken on such symbolic and ideological importance for Putin and for Russia only made the upheaval in Ukraine seem even more humiliating. Some of Putin's supporters thought it really had been incited in order to sully the moment. Putin spent the hours before the closing ceremonies, another lavish ode to Russia with even a knowing, self-deprecating wink to the snowflake gaffe in the opening ceremonies, complaining on the telephone to Angela Merkel that the Europeans had not enforced the agreement that Yanukovych had signed, as if they could have forced him to remain in Kiev. Putin said nothing publicly about Ukraine in Sochi that day, or the next, when he hosted a breakfast for the organizing committee, decorated Russia's medalists, and planted 33 trees, one for each medal. He would say nothing, in fact, for 9 more days, even as he set in motion a secret operation that morning of February 23rd, one that not even his own ministers knew was coming. On February 25th, he met with his National Security Council for the second time since the violence erupted in Kiev. The council's 12 members included Medvedev, the ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and the interior, the leaders of both houses of parliament, and the directors of foreign intelligence and the FSB. One of them, Valentina Matvienko, the chairwoman of the Federation Council, emerged from the meeting and declared that it was impossible that Russia would intervene militarily in Ukraine to halt the chaos. Neither she nor many of the others in the Kremlin knew then that Russia already had. Putin would punish Ukraine by dismembering it. The next day, he announced a snap military exercise that mobilized tens of thousands of troops in western Russia, as well as the headquarters of the Air Force and Air Defense Commands. The exercise had been planned for months, but the timing allowed the Kremlin to disguise the sudden deployment of thousands of Russia's elite special operations troops. Secrecy was essential, as was deniability. Putin could not be sure of the potential international response, from NATO above all, and wanted to test the resolve of the world's leaders before he acknowledged the extent of his plan. Before dawn, on the morning of February 27th, commandos from Russia and troops from the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet and other bases in Crimea seized the Crimean Regional Parliament and other important buildings on the peninsula, as well as two airfields. The troops were well-equipped and heavily armed, but their uniforms bore no insignia. The soldiers had been ordered to remove them. Within the next 24 hours, thousands more troops landed at the airfields and fanned out, securing the peninsula without significant violence, despite several tense confrontations with startled Ukrainian troops, who, amid the political havoc in Kiev, were under orders not to resist. The Russian commandos became known as Little Green Men, or Polite People, preserving Russia's increasingly unconvincing denials of any involvement. A hastily organized session of the regional parliament, which was held behind closed doors, elected a new government and declared, in violation of Ukrainian law, that a referendum would be held on May 25th on the question of giving Crimea greater autonomy. Even Putin's supporters were surprised. Putin had acted after consultations only with a small circle of aides that included the men he had always trusted, the men whom he had kept by his side since they all joined the KGB: Sergei Ivanov, Nikolai Petrushev, and Alexander Bortnikov. They shared his deepest thoughts, his suspicion of NATO's ambitions, and his rage over the culpability of Western nations in rushing to embrace the new government that was taking shape after Yanukovych's retreat. There were uncanny echoes of the decision in 1979 to invade Afghanistan, which was also made by a close, cloistered cadre of the Soviet leadership on false pretenses. The result of the secrecy was confusion among the country's political establishment, underscoring how much decision-making now rested solely in Putin's hands. Ever since his return in 2012, Putin had narrowed the funnel of information that reached him to exclude the diplomats, economic ministers, or others who might have offered advice on the possible consequences of what was unfolding. Putin's actions now left his spokesman and even his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, repeating falsehoods, denying there were any Russians in Crimea, even as they seized its strategic sites one by one. When the United Nations Security Council met in emergency session in New York on February 27th, the day after the Little Green Men appeared, Russia's ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, was unprepared to explain even the basic facts of what was happening, because, it seemed, he clearly did not know them. That same day, Yanukovych finally resurfaced in Russia, a week after fleeing Kiev. He held a surreal press conference at a shopping center in Rostov-on-Don in southern Russia, not far from the Ukrainian border, where he claimed he remained the legitimate president of Ukraine, even as protesters and journalists were combing through his presidential estate outside of Kiev, rifling through evidence of his personal extravagance and professional corruption. Yanukovych said he supported the territorial integrity of the country and opposed any military intervention by Russia. He too was unaware that Putin had already launched one. The day after Yanukovych surfaced, Putin submitted a proposal to the Federation Council to authorize the use of military force in Ukraine. The council speaker, Valentina Matviyenko, who had only 3 days earlier ruled out any intervention, promptly convened a rare Saturday session that, with remarkable alacrity, approved Putin's request. After a vitriolic debate in which speaker after speaker railed against the evil of Ukraine and the United States, the 90 of 166 members who were present voted unanimously to give Putin free rein to invade its neighbor, after he already had. It was only after that, on March 2nd, that Putin summoned Yanukovych to his residence outside Moscow and forced him to draft and sign a letter dated the day before, that is, before the Federation Council's authorization vote, asking Russia to intervene. Ukraine is on the brink of a civil war. In the country, there is chaos and anarchy, the letter said, blending indisputable fact with the paranoia that infused Putin's closest circle of advisers. Under the influence of Western countries, there are open acts of terror and violence. People are being persecuted for language and political reasons. So in this regard, I would call on the President of Russia, Mr. Putin, asking him to use the armed forces of the Russian Federation to establish legitimacy, peace, law and order, stability, and defend the people of Ukraine. The day he pressed Yanukovych to sign the letter, Putin held a series of telephone calls with world leaders who strained to understand what exactly was unfolding. The most crucial was the one with Angela Merkel. Only 2 days before, he had told her that there were no Russian troops in Crimea, but now he acknowledged that there were, something no Russian official would admit publicly until Putin did in April, 6 weeks after the fact. Putin repeated his warnings that ethnic Russians faced violence in Ukraine, forcing him to act. Merkel, the leader who remained Putin's best interlocutor on the continent, now turned sharply against him. She telephoned Barack Obama even as he was on the phone with Putin afterward, and when they spoke, she dropped her cautious approach to the crisis and took a far harsher stance. The United States, soon followed by the European Union and other members of the G8, warned that Russia risked its international standing and withering sanctions if it pressed a territorial claim on Crimea. Putin's strategy at this point unfolded haphazardly, catching even his underlings off guard. He was making decisions alone and off the cuff. After conspicuously attending the snap military exercises at the Kirillovsky Range north of Moscow, Putin returned to Moscow on March 4th and for the first time spoke publicly about the crisis that had gripped Ukraine and the world for the previous 2 weeks. He met with a small group of journalists from the Kremlin pool at Novaya Gazeta. Unlike his carefully orchestrated yearly press conferences, this one was hastily organized, and even he seemed ill-prepared. His answers were confused and, at times, contradictory. He appeared uncomfortable, alternately slouching and squirming in his seat. He declared Yanukovych the only legitimate president of Ukraine, but said there was no legitimate leader in Ukraine that he could talk to. "I think he has no political future," he added regarding Yanukovych, condescendingly, "and I have told him so." A change in power in Ukraine was probably necessary, but what happened in Kiev was an armed seizure of power that had, like the genie suddenly let out of the bottle, flooded the capital with nationalists, swastika-wearing semi-fascists, and anti-Semites. "And yet," he added, "we have no enemies in Ukraine." And again, he raised the question of America's wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and Libya, which were inextricably involved in this crisis only in his mind. Obama had, in fact, reacted slowly to the events in Ukraine, distracted by the crises in the Middle East. But Putin was convinced that the Americans, even more than the Europeans, had instigated the upheaval. "I sometimes get the feeling that somewhere across that huge puddle, in America, people sit in a lab and conduct experiments, as if with rats, without actually understanding the consequences of what they are doing." He obliquely acknowledged that Russia had reinforced its troops at the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol, but when pressed on the soldiers in Russian uniforms, though without insignia, who were occupying key buildings, he dissembled, calling them local self-defense units. "You can go to a store and buy any kind of uniform," he said. Putin expressed support for the right of people in Crimea to hold a referendum, but emphasized that he was not considering the possibility of Crimea joining Russia. And yet 2 days later, with international opposition growing, Crimea's new parliament abruptly announced that it had accelerated its plans and would hold the referendum on the peninsula's fate in a mere 10 days, on March 16th. Despite the opposition of ethnic Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, once horribly repressed under Stalin and free to return openly only after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the results of the referendum were now merely a formality. The following day, despite Putin's own disavowal only days before, the Kremlin made it clear that Crimea was returning to the motherland. As leaders of the Duma and the Federation met with a delegation from Crimea, while an officially sanctioned mass rally was held in Red Square, which swayed with Russian flags and banners. "Crimea is Russian land," many signs said. The slogans, like the new mission of Vladimir Putin, was soon condensed into an incantation that simultaneously conveyed both pride and pique, Putin's rebuttal to what he considered years of mounting disrespect for Russia. It would become a rallying cry with surprisingly deep resonance, though one that Putin, forced by an unexpected sequence of events, did not anticipate would define his legacy and Russia's for years to come. Krim nash, Crimea is ours. And on March 18th, 2 days after a referendum that was held under the barrels of Russian rifles and widely denounced as a farce, it was. Putin appeared in the Grand Kremlin Palace before the country's political elite, to a one, publicly at least, fully behind him, and declared Crimea and, separately, Sevastopol to be new constituent parts of the Russian Federation. "Everything in Crimea speaks of our shared history and pride," he told them, invoking the legendary place where Prince Vladimir was baptized, thus begetting Rus itself, and the battles, from Balaklava to Sevastopol, that symbolize Russian military glory and outstanding valor. The audience applauded and cheered, interrupting his speech repeatedly. Some had tears in their eyes. Putin appeared later that evening at a rally and concert in Red Square, organized as a national celebration that would become a hallowed holiday. After a long, hard, and exhaustive journey at sea, Crimea and Sevastopol are returning to their home harbor, to the native shores, to the home port, to Russia, he told the pulsating crowd. Among the songs played that night was a sentimental Soviet song called Sevastopol Waltz. It had been written after the Great Patriotic War in 1953, a year after Putin was born. Most Russians of a certain age and temperament could sing along. "We returned home on the edge of the Soviet land. Again, as before, the chestnuts are in bloom. And again, I was waiting for you. Along the boulevards we will walk, and, as in youth, we will sing." The last nation to annex the territory of another was Iraq in 1990, when the armies of Saddam Hussein swept through Kuwait. Iraq's invasion, occupation, and annexation prompted universal condemnation, and ultimately the formation of an American-led military coalition that, under the auspices of the United Nations, and with no objection from the Soviet Union, expelled the Iraqis a mere 7 months later. Putin understood that. He knew the risks he took by seizing foreign territory. Even in 2008, when Russia thrust into Georgia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia were disputed territories policed by Russian peacekeepers and under attack by the Georgian military. Crimea was indisputably part of Ukraine, however, and faced no military or security threat. Putin, in a matter of days, had not only violated the sovereignty of a neighboring nation, he upended what many had presumed to be the immutable post-Cold War order that had taken root after the violent breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, one which many in Europe hoped would usher in an era of peaceful cooperation and integration after the bloodshed of the 20th century. Putin himself had repeatedly advocated as much, denouncing the unilateral use of force by the United States and its allies as a threat to an international system that protected the rights of sovereign nations from attack. He had made this exact argument only months before, when Barack Obama debated a military strike against Syria for its use of chemical weapons. Putin understood what the reaction would be to the annexation, but he also calculated that the world would not dare to act as it had against Saddam Hussein in 1990. Iraq had been a weak nation, but Russia was a resurgent superpower. The West would not act against Russia, certainly not on behalf of Ukraine, just as it had not acted in 2008 to preserve Georgia's territorial integrity. Russia was no longer an enervated Soviet Union in its twilight, and Putin was now prepared to act in what he, and he alone, considered the country's national interest. He seized Crimea from Ukraine because he could, because he believed that a superpower had the legal and moral authority to do so, just as the United States had been doing ever since the end of the Cold War. The operation Putin ordered in Crimea reflected the lessons the military had learned from the war in Georgia, as well as the benefits of the military modernization he had overseen since he was prime minister. Russia's military budget had nearly doubled since 2005, reaching an estimated $84 billion in 2014. It lagged behind only the United States and China, but spent more as a percentage of its gross domestic product than any major economy. The effects of the modernization were manifested in new weaponry, including ships and fighter jets that increasingly challenged American and NATO's air defenses, but also in the training and equipping of its most elite forces, like those ordered into Ukraine. The seizure of Crimea demonstrated a more capable, and to other neighbors in Europe, a more ominous, military machine than any since the Red Army disintegrated. It blended hard power with soft power, speed and stealth, obfuscation and relentless propaganda meant to deflect culpability until it was too late to do anything about it. By the time Putin acknowledged that Russian forces had in fact taken control of the entire peninsula before the referendum on its status, the annexation was already a fait accompli. And despite the international opprobrium, it would not soon be reversed. Putin scrambled to justify the annexation, and his shifting arguments echoed throughout the diplomatic and military establishments, and thus in the media the Kremlin controlled. He argued that Crimea had once been part of the historic Russian Empire, that it had been administered in Soviet times from Moscow until Nikita Khrushchev bequeathed it to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic in 1954, that it remained home of the new Russia's Black Sea Fleet, that the new government in Ukraine was illegitimate, that the people of Crimea voted for independence from Ukraine, that they faced imminent danger from marauding fascists. Sometimes he simply asserted a moral equivalency that the United States had invaded other countries, so why could not Russia? The most ominous rationale, for many, was that he had intervened to protect his Russian compatriots in Crimea. That is, not citizens of Russia, but those Russians who, as he often pointed out, found themselves adrift in foreign countries when the Soviet Union splintered in 1991 into separate successor nations. For years, he had extolled the Ruski Mir, or Russian world, the community united across borders by language, culture, and faith. But never before had he used the notion as a rationale for military action. It was an argument that had uncomfortable parallels to those Adolf Hitler used in 1938 to claim Austria and later the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia for the Volksgenossen. The question now was, where would Putin's policy stop? Other parts of Ukraine included significant populations of ethnic Russians, as did Kazakhstan and the three former Soviet republics now in NATO and protected by a mutual defense pledge contained in Article 5 of the alliance's charter, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Few thought that Putin would risk a military confrontation with NATO by attacking one of its member states, but no one seemed certain that Putin's calculations were entirely rational anymore. Within days of the annexation of Crimea, protesters in eastern Ukraine, incited or joined by Russian intelligence agents and volunteer fighters, began seizing administrative buildings in several cities. In two provincial capitals, Donetsk and Luhansk, they denounced the new central authorities in Kiev and declared the creation of People's Republics, scheduling their own referendums for May. The events unfolded just as officials in the regions had warned they would do after the political upheaval in 2004. supported by compatriots across the border in Russia. Both regions included large populations of ethnic Russians, though not outright majorities, whose political sympathies were far closer to Putin's Russia than to Kiev, especially after the upheaval in the winter of 2013 to 2014. They were far more susceptible to the propaganda of the Kremlin-controlled media, which was widely available in eastern Ukraine and which portrayed those now in power as rabid nationalists who would deny Russians basic rights, who would suppress them, even torture and kill them. Although he stopped short of expressing explicit support for the protests, Putin repeatedly denounced the Ukrainian authorities and restated Russia's right to protect the interests of the Russian world. Within weeks, he used the term Novorossiya, or New Russia, to evoke a historical claim over the swath of Ukrainian territory from Odessa to the Russian border that Imperial Russia seized in the 18th century from the declining Ottoman Empire. The ethnic fault lines that rived Ukraine, like others left behind by the messy breakup of the Soviet Union, now ruptured, perhaps irrevocably. The Americans and Europeans were caught by surprise by the move on Crimea, as they had been by the bloodshed in Kiev and by Yanukovych's abrupt flight on February 22nd. The initial international reaction to the annexation and the unrest in eastern Ukraine was confused and halting, hobbled by Putin's subterfuge and the startling ease with which thousands of Russian commandos managed to seize more than 10,000 square miles of territory populated by nearly 2 million people. In the days before Crimea's referendum, leaders in Europe and the United States hoped that diplomatic pressure would work. When the referendum went ahead anyway, they calculated that the threat of economic punishment and international censure would still be deterrent enough. On March 17th, the day after the referendum, the United States and European Union announced sanctions against nearly a dozen officials in Russia and in Crimea, but they included only those like Valentina Matviyenko of the Federation Council and the former Kremlin political strategist Vladislav Surkov, who, though prominent, had no influence over the decisions Putin was making now. Putin paid no heed to the initial response. He brushed aside the increasingly stern warnings not only of Barack Obama, whose relations with him after the adoption ban, Edward Snowden, and Syria were already beyond repair, but also of leaders like Angela Merkel, who remain the counterpart on the continent most vested in maintaining close relations with Russia. He so strained credulity in his conversations with Merkel, denouncing the nefarious European actions against Russia, that she confided in Obama her belief that Putin was now living in another world. Putin's intransigence proved to be unifying, shoring up international opposition. Russia was expelled from the G8, whose annual summit was to be held in the summer of 2014 in the newly rebuilt Sochi. 2 days after the annexation, the United States ratcheted up the sanctions, followed by the European Union. This time, the sanctions targeted those closest to Putin, intending to change his behavior by inflicting punishment on the friends who had amassed their fortunes during his presidency. They included his old judo partners, Arkady and Boris Rotenberg, Vladimir Yakunin, Yuri Kovalchuk and Andrei Fursenko from the Azura Dacha Cooperative, and Gennady Timchenko. Echoing the claims made by Putin's critics for years, the Treasury Department in Washington asserted that Putin himself had investments in Timchenko's company, Gunvor, and may have access to Gunvor funds. The Americans accused Kovalchuk's Bank Russia of acting as the personal banker of senior officials in the Kremlin, including Putin. The sanctions barred those targeted from traveling to the United States, froze their assets, and forbade American companies from doing business with them, effectively restricting their activities involving dollars almost anywhere. The American and European sanctions would continue to expand, singling out more officials and businesses, including the Rutenberg's Bank, SMP, the Russian abbreviation for the Northern Sea Route, which coursed through the Arctic, and ultimately entire sectors of the economy, including Rosneft and its ambitious plans to extract oil from the Arctic. And yet, these new sanctions had no more obvious effect than the sanctions against the aides and acolytes of the outer orbits of Putin's power. Indeed, no more obvious effect than no sanctions at all. Putin's resolve could not be challenged even by those closest to him. All of those sanctioned, the high and the low, the close friends and the acquaintances, the agents of influence and the mere hangers-on, owed their places within the system to him. They were the new elite of the Putin era, above the law and thus protected by one man's justice. Their power and their fortunes relied on his power and their loyalty to him. Vladimir Yakunin, for whom the sanctions seemed a personal affront, said his old friend would never let anyone try to dissuade him from any decision made in what he considered the best interests of Russia. He would consider even the effort to do so an act of betrayal. "He will not forget that, or forgive that," Yakunin said. And no one dared. One after another, those facing sanctions expressed fealty and solidarity with the leader, proclaiming their willingness to make any sacrifice that was necessary. "You have to pay for everything in this life," Gennady Timchenko said, rather richly, since he had managed to sell his shares in Gunvor to his partner the day before the sanctions were announced, suggesting that he had insider information of the looming threat and moved quickly to protect his assets from seizure. Timchenko acknowledged his Gulfstream jet had been grounded because he could no longer buy parts to service it, that his wife's credit cards had been suspended, and that he could no longer safely vacation in Europe with his family and their dog Romy, the offspring of Putin's beloved Kony. "But one can put up with business costs and personal inconveniences when state interests are at stake. These are trifles on the background of global problems." Protests like the ones that materialized in Simferopol and other cities of Crimea in February spread across Ukraine. In Odessa, a violent confrontation in May between pro-Russian protesters and government supporters in the city's center ended in a fire at the old House of Trade Unions that killed 48 people. The referendums held that month by the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk were as hastily organized and legally dubious as the one in Crimea. Ukraine's security service claimed to have captured a recording of one rebel leader, Dmitry Baitsov, of the Russian Orthodox Army, complaining that he could not oversee a vote because a large force of Ukrainian troops and weaponry remained in the region. "We can't conduct it lawfully as long as these cocksuckers are here," he said. The man allegedly on the other end of the line was Alexander Borkashov, a notorious neo-Nazi in Russia, who in 1993 had joined those who defended the White House in Moscow in defiance of Boris Yeltsin's decrees. He told him to press ahead anyway, fixing a result of, say, 89%. "Are you going to walk around collecting papers?" Borkashov barked at him. "Are you fucking insane?" When the votes were counted, the total mirrored his recommendation, with 89% in favor, while in Luhansk, the tally exceeded an improbable 96%. The referendums were followed by escalating violent clashes. The country descended into open war, one that the chief of Russia's general staff, Valery Gerasimov, seemingly anticipated the year before, when he outlined a new military doctrine drafted after Putin's return to the presidency in reaction to the uprisings in the Arab world. In the 21st century, we have seen a tendency toward blurring the lines between the states of war and peace, General Gerasimov wrote. Wars are no longer declared, and, having begun, proceed according to an unfamiliar template. The experience of military conflicts, including those connected with the so-called colored revolutions in North Africa and the Middle East, confirm that a perfectly thriving state can, in a matter of months and even days, be transformed into an arena of fierce armed conflict, become a victim of foreign intervention, and sink into a web of chaos, humanitarian catastrophe, and civil war. And so it would be. The annexation of Crimea had proved nearly effortless, but the situation in eastern Ukraine turned out to be far more complicated, and the uncertainty of Putin's intentions muddled the efforts by the insurgents. The newly elected president, who replaced the self-exiled Yanukovych, the chocolate tycoon Petro Poroshenko, also acted with far greater determination to hold on to the rebellious regions in the east than the provisional government had been able to do in the case of Crimea in March. The Ukrainian military, joined by irregular militias that had formed during the events on the Maidan, counterattacked and moved to retake territory that was no longer government-controlled, and with each passing day, the fighting turned into civil war. Officially, at least, Putin maintained an assiduous distance from those calling for independence in Donetsk and Luhansk. With the sanctions tightening further than he probably expected, he even called for postponing the votes on independence. The Americans and Europeans hoped that the diplomatic isolation facing Russia and the intensifying sanctions were, at last, altering Putin's choices, forcing him and other officials into more and more improbable denials of Russian involvement. The insurgents, nevertheless, had ample support from Russia, both officially and unofficially. Their leaders, at first, were ethnic Russians, including a former or possible current military intelligence officer, Igor Girkin, who went by the nom de guerre Igor Stilkov. The militias that formed, and there were many, with unclear chains of command, included local fighters and volunteers from Russia, who, the Kremlin insisted unconvincingly, joined the uprisings purely out of a fraternal desire to defend the Ruski Mir. Some had fought in the previous conflicts along the unraveling fringes of the Soviet Empire in the early 1990s, like Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, and the sliver of territory in Moldova known as Transnistria. They were bolstered by Russian commandos and intelligence officers and later regular troops, dispatched as volunteers by their commanders, with the promise of extra payments and required on the Kremlin's orders to resign from the military and wear no Russian insignia. Putin did not want to risk an open Russian intervention, and the obfuscation masked the extent of Russia's activity enough to create confusion and, as he hoped, division and debate within Europe over how forcefully to respond. As Gerasimov predicted, the conflict in eastern Ukraine blurred the lines between war and peace, between instigator and defender. The Kremlin continued to deny the existence of Russian fighters and weaponry in Ukraine long after the first coffins of soldiers returned to Russia, buried in secrecy, just as the bodies of those who had died for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. It would do so even after Russian soldiers were captured inside Ukraine and paraded by the authorities there. On June 6th, Putin traveled to France to attend ceremonies commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Allied landings in Normandy on D-Day. His ostracism was palpable. The G7, having expelled Russia, met that week in Brussels instead of Sochi. Including him in the memorial ceremonies paid homage to the Soviet Union's contribution to the defeat of the Nazis. But Russia's intervention in a new war strained even that courtesy. The European leaders became increasingly frustrated with Putin's denials of culpability and his insistence that only a political resolution was possible, as he was equally frustrated by Ukrainian efforts to reassert control over the regions in the east. Angela Merkel and François Hollande tested his stated desire for a peaceful political solution in Ukraine by brokering peace talks. For the first time since the crisis began, he met Petro Poroshenko in Normandy, acting as proxy for the rebel regions he disavowed providing any support to. The fighting, however, intensified anyway, with government forces and insurgents trading fire with heavier weapons, including mortar and artillery. A month later, Putin met again with Merkel in Brazil ahead of a World Cup final between Germany and Argentina. He was in attendance as the leader of the host nation for the tournament in 2018, a highly anticipated event for which he had already launched a new mega project of stadium construction, but one that would be dogged by questions over improprieties surrounding Russia's winning bid. Even as they met again, pledging to negotiate a new ceasefire, there were new reports of Russian equipment crossing the border. A day later, a Ukrainian AN-26 military cargo jet, flying at an altitude of more than 20,000 feet, was shot down along the Russian border near Luhansk. Its downing, coming after the destruction of another military transport jet as it landed in June, was a portentous sign of the increasing firepower of the insurgents. 2 days after that, a Sukhoi fighter jet went down, hit by a sophisticated surface-to-air missile of a type the irregular fighters were not known to possess. On the afternoon of July 17th, the website used by Igor Stilkov posted a note announcing the downing of yet another AN-26, this one near the village of Tares, located between Donetsk and the Russian border. "We warned them, don't fly in our sky," the statement, attributed to Stilkov, declared triumphantly. The Ukrainians later claimed to have intercepted telephone calls between a fighter and a Russian intelligence officer confirming the downing. It was not a Ukrainian military jet, though. The wreckage that fell from the sky belonged to a Boeing 777, carrying 283 passengers and 15 crew members on Malaysia Airways Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. Their bodies landed amid the debris over several square miles of farmland sown with wheat. By all accounts except that of the Russians, a surface-to-air missile from a mobile battery known as a 9K-37 Buk struck the airliner as it flew over the Donetsk region. Witnesses, including reporters from the Associated Press, reported seeing the battery moving through the villages nearby, while subsequent reports traced the unit to the Russian military, specifically the 53rd Anti-Aircraft Missile Brigade, based in the city of Kursk. The unit was said to have crossed the border from Russia the night before and returned again, carrying only 3 of its 4 missiles. A preliminary investigation by the government of the Netherlands also concluded that the airline exploded in midair, the damage to its fuselage consistent with the explosion of a missile like the Buk, not a missile fired from a fighter jet, as Russia's Ministry of Defense quickly asserted. Putin, who was returning from his trip to Brazil when the tragedy occurred, spoke by telephone with Merkel and Obama that day, but made only terse statements in public. He said nothing about the evident source of the missile, neither to confirm nor deny Russian involvement, but blamed the tragedy on the resumption of fighting in eastern Ukraine, suggesting that it was the fault of the government of Ukraine for trying to regain territory being held by armed insurgents. "No one should, and no one has the right, to use this tragedy to pursue his own political goals," he said, in an unusual television address delivered in the wee hours of the morning on July 21st. He looked tired and drawn, standing shakily at his office desk, his eyes reddened. "Rather than dividing us, tragedies of this sort should bring people together. All those who are responsible for the situation in the region must take greater responsibility before their own peoples and before the peoples of the countries whose citizens were killed in this disaster." And yet, he took no responsibility upon himself for any role in the tragedy, or in an increasingly deadly conflict that would kill thousands and drive hundreds of thousands of people from their homes on a continent that had dreamed of putting its bloody history behind it. The world, at least much of the West, turned definitively against Putin after Flight 17. "Putin's missile," the British tabloid The Sun declared, and even more sober news organizations drew an inexorable line of responsibility. Without Putin, there would have been no annexation of Crimea, no war in eastern Ukraine, no wreckage scattered across the wheat fields. This was Putin's war, and the best efforts of the Kremlin's propagandists to muddy the waters by broadcasting false claims and conspiracy theories did nothing to obviate the blame. Even if he did not understand it, others around him did. He could have reined in the rebel leaders, withdrawn the Russian forces and equipment, facilitated the international investigation into the Downing, and found and turned over to justice those responsible for the murder of 298 people. And yet, he could no more do that than he could acknowledge the other failings of his presidency, the other sensational crimes, the corruption that erected the system of loyalty that he had created. Putin had made himself the symbol of the resurgent Russia, and the idea had to be maintained without acknowledgement of fault. Only in a cult of power can the leader be inseparable from the state. There is Putin, and there is Russia. The man who had replaced Vladislav Surkov in 2011, as the Kremlin's political strategist Vyacheslav Volodin said in 2014, "No Putin, no Russia." The rift between Russia and the West now seemed irrevocable, and it was deliberate. The United States had already expanded its sanctions the day before the downing of Flight 17, and in the wake of the accident, opposition in Europe to intensifying its sanctions evaporated as well. Entire sectors of the economy, including banking and energy, now face sanctions, not just the officials and friends close to Putin. By the middle of 2014, capital flight had reached $75 billion for the year as those with cash sought safe harbors offshore. By the end of the year, $150 billion had fled the country. The economy, already slowing, slumped badly as investments withered. The value of the ruble crashed, despite efforts by the central bank to shore it up. The price of oil slumped, which Putin blamed on a conspiracy between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and that strained the budget, depleting the reserves that Putin had steadfastly built up throughout his years in power. Russia plunged into an economic crisis as bad as the ones in 1998 and 2009. Putin's tactics had backfired. Many in the West cheered, seeing the economic crisis as evidence of the self-inflicted pain of Putin's actions. But the isolation also fed Putin's view that the crises confronting Russia economically and diplomatically were part of a vast conspiracy effort to weaken Russia, to weaken his rule. The day after the downing of Flight 17, the International Arbitration Court in The Hague finally issued its verdicts in the cases brought by the shareholders of Yukos over the expropriation of the company, ordering Russia to pay more than $50 billion in damages, citing Putin's own defense of the auction of the company's crown jewel a decade before as evidence of government collusion. Each step against Russia he now believed to be a cynical, calculated attack against him. His actions belied a deep sense of grievance and betrayal, sharpened by the crisis that unfolded at the very moment Russia had achieved his Olympic dream. He was impervious to the threats of sanctions or international isolation because he now believed Russia's views, its interests, would never be respected, as he felt he had never been shown adequate respect. All the more so since he returned to the Kremlin in 2012 after the four-year interregnum as prime minister. Putin had not miscalculated in his actions against Crimea and later in eastern Ukraine. He simply no longer cared how the West would respond. The change in Putin's demeanor became acute after the downing of Flight 17, according to his old friend Sergei Roldugin. "I noticed that the more he is being teased, the tougher he becomes," Roldugin said. It was as if the political upheaval in Ukraine affected Putin deeply and personally, like a taunt on the schoolyard that forced him to lash out. Merkel, according to Roldugin, infuriated him by being dismissive of the concerns he raised about the radicals in the ranks of Ukraine's new government, about the threats to the country's Russian minority, about the atrocities being committed by Ukrainian troops against civilians. Everyone wanted to blame him for the missile that destroyed the airliner. But what about the atrocities committed by the Ukrainian government against those in the East? where once he had been patient with Merkel and other leaders, he was now annoyed. Where once compromising, he was now unbending. All this has annoyed him, and he has become more, I don't want to say aggressive, but more indifferent, Roldugin explained. He knows that we shall resolve it one way or another, but he does not want to compromise anymore. For Putin, the personal had become policy. The pragmatism of his first two terms as president had long before ended, but now the upheaval in Ukraine signaled a fundamental break in the trajectory that he had followed since Yeltsin unexpectedly handed him the presidency at the dawn of the new millennium. For 14 years in power, he had focused on restoring Russia to its place among the world's powers by integrating into a globalized economy, profiting from and exploiting the financial institutions of the free market, banks, stock markets, trading houses, to the benefit of those tycoons closest to him, of course, but also Russians generally. Now, he would reassert Russia's power with or without the recognition of the West, shunning its universal values, its democracy and rule of law, as something alien to Russia, something intended not to include Russia but to subjugate it. The nation became hostage to the psychosomatic quirks of its leader, the novelist Vladimir Sorokin wrote after the annexation. All his fears, passions, weaknesses, and complexes become state policy. If he is paranoid, the whole country must fear enemies and spies. If he has insomnia, all the ministries must work at night. If he's a teetotaler, everyone must stop drinking. If he's a drunk, everyone should booze it up. If he doesn't like America, which his beloved KGB fought against, the whole population must dislike the United States. Opposition to Putin, to Putinism, continued to exist, but the events of 2014 drove it even further toward the margins of society. The leaders who did pose a challenge, or might once have, were under siege more than ever. Some left even before the events in Ukraine, including Garry Kasparov, who feared his imminent arrest after Alexander Bastrykin's investigative committee telephoned and spoke to his mother while he was traveling. A telephone call from the committee was now as ominous a warning as the KGB's knock on the door had once been. Kasparov was followed by others hounded out of Russia by investigators. The economist, Sergei Guriev, who had advised Medvedev, a former central banker, Sergei Alexashenko, and one of Alexei Navalny's deputies, who worked on his anti-corruption campaign, Vladimir Askurov, who received political asylum in Britain. Pavel Durov, the creator of Russia's version of Facebook called VKontakte, and an example of a dynamic new generation of Russians, sold his remaining stake in the company and left the country, saying later, "Since I'm obviously a believer in free markets, it's hard for me to understand the current direction of the country." Boris Berezovsky, the man who claimed to be Putin's progenitor and became his biggest nemesis, died outside of London in 2013, ostensibly a suicide hung by a cord in his bathroom. As ever when Berezovsky was involved, suspicion of a more nefarious end to his life never subsided entirely. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, amnestied by Putin in the winter of 2013, relocated to Switzerland and reopened his Open Russia once again to promote democracy in Russia. He offered himself as a potential leader of a provisional government that might one day serve as a transition to a new Russia, but he dared not return to the country. At home, those who challenged the Kremlin's narrative on Ukraine were shunned. A prominent historian, Andrei Zubov, was fired from his post at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations for comparing the annexation of Crimea to Hitler's Anschluss in Austria in 1938, an event, he noted, that was followed by war and finally the fall of the Third Reich. "Friends," he implored in Vaidomosti, "history repeats itself." His ostracism was as swift and severe as the satirist Viktor Shenderovich's lament over a skater's gold at the Olympics. Vydomosti's founding editor, Leonid Brzezinski, announced his own exile in a newspaper column not long afterward, speaking for a generation of intelligentsia who saw Putin's Russia as no longer compatible with the relative freedoms to which they had grown accustomed. He wrote in the Moscow Times that he was not a panicked rat abandoning the sinking Russian ship. "I am more a sailor who, seeing that the captain had changed course toward a port of ill repute, and with loudspeakers blaring his intent, quietly and without panicking, lowered the lifeboat and began rowing toward the port for which all of us had originally set sail." Others stayed on, fighting an increasingly lonely battle against Putin and the forces of nationalism he had unleashed. Alexei Navalny, after being arrested while protesting the verdicts in the Bologna cases at the closing of the Sochi Olympics, spent most of 2014 under house arrest, confined to his small apartment in a Soviet-era block in southern Moscow. The only opposition leader to have emerged from the grassroots of society, one who was not beholden to the Kremlin and charismatic enough to win a following independent of its influence, was forbidden for months from meeting anyone except his relatives and from using the internet, the medium he had used so effectively to make himself a threat to Putin's system. With surveillance equipment brazenly installed around his apartment, he whiled away his days playing Grand Theft Auto, leaving only to attend court hearings, accompanied by a police escort. With prosecutors opening new cases, including one involving a stolen street poster as a gift, and another that would send his brother, Oleg, to prison, his court appearances became more and more regular. The Kremlin shadow loomed over him as it had the dissidents of the past. "What have we won?" he said inside his apartment at the end of 2014, when the terms of his arrest were eased somewhat, musing on Putin's annexation of Crimea and the international demonization that followed in its wake. "Now, literally, no one likes us," he said. Even Ukraine, a natural ally, now hated Russia, if not Russians. The war overshadowed the work of Navalny's anti-corruption campaign, which continued to expose the neo-feudal links between power and money. It became a war against all things Western, including those who would advocate for greater political openness and transparency. It permeated society, even the nightly weather reports Navalny watched on television, which took to warning that the situation in eastern Ukraine was heating up. Putin had plunged the country into a perpetual war, and thus a perpetual mobilization, Navalny said. He rallied the country behind a manifest destiny that it had once lost, regardless of the cost in international standing. And yet, the more disastrous Putin's decisions were, the more powerful he became. With the country at war, his position seemed even more unassailable. It was a contradiction that Navalny, like others at home and abroad, struggled to understand. "In terms of strengthening his regime, Putin won," he said, with an air of resignation. "In terms of Russia's strategic interests, we lost." Boris Nemtsov, who managed to get himself elected to the Regional Assembly in Yaroslavl, also continued to campaign against Putin, relying on the legal immunity that his legislative seat provided as some measure of protection. He fulminated against the war in postings on Facebook and Twitter, describing Putin as a ghoul who needed blood to survive. And yet he too acknowledged that Putin seemed resistant to the growing body of evidence that Russians were fighting and dying in Ukraine. He complained that the international sanctions and diplomatic isolation remained half-hearted. He wanted stronger international efforts to end Putin's regime, not to negotiate with it. "He's not in isolation," Nemtsov said. "He talks to Merkel. He talks to everyone." Nemtsov carried on, undaunted, compiling evidence for another of his pamphlets, like those on Gazprom, on corruption, on Sochi. This time, he would document the Russian involvement in the fighting in eastern Ukraine, on Putin's orders, and try to awaken the political conscience of the Russian people to the crimes being committed. He would call this one simply Putin, War. He would not finish it, though. One night in February 2015, he was shot to death as he walked along the bridge leading from Red Square. He died within sight of the Kremlin. His death, like Politkovskaya's in 2006, a casualty of a larger war. It was no random act of violence, but a highly organized assassination carried out in the middle of one of the most heavily policed places on the planet. His murder was linked to assassins from Chechnya, some allegedly close to Ramzan Kadyrov, the man Putin had relied on to reestablish control over a region that once threatened to spin free of Russia, but whose brutal rule now operated without constraints. Putin's indefatigable spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, let it be known that Putin was shocked by the tragedy, but also that Nemtsov's influence had not been great. As with Politkovskaya's murder, or Alexander Litvinenko's, or Sergei Magnitsky's, Putin may not have been personally involved or aware, as his supporters insisted. By then, however, it was difficult to argue that his epic was not washed by the blood of his harshest critics. On July 31, 2014, some of Russia's richest men gathered in Moscow at the headquarters of the Russian Soccer Federation to deal with an unexpected consequence of Putin's annexation of Crimea. They included the Federation's officials, as well as the owners of its most prominent professional teams. Sergei Galitsky, the owner of a supermarket chain and the Krasnodar Football Club. Suleyman Kerimov, the tycoon who owned Anji Mahachkala in Dagestan, and Vladimir Yakunin, whose Russian railway sponsored Lokomotiv Moskva. On the agenda was a vote by the Foundation's executive committee to absorb Crimea's three clubs into the Russian League, and those gathered there harbored reservations about the risk of sanctions that could extend to them and their clubs. They could be barred from traveling to the West, expelled from competitions in Europe. "I don't have any doubts that we're all going to fall under sanctions," Galitsky complained, according to a transcript of their testy exchange, which was surreptitiously recorded and leaked to the newspaper Novaya Gazeta. He expressed frustration that everything he had built over the last quarter century, a chain of stores called Magnit that employed 250,000 people and was worth $30 billion, could be lost. Others in the committee's conference room shared his concern, as well as his fear of displeasing the chief executive. Galitsky and the others clearly hoped to avoid having to vote, circuitously debating whether they needed to and whether a statement by the sports minister, Vitaly Mutko, could be as good as the word of Putin himself. None wanted to be put on the record with a vote, as the head of the union was insisting, nor did they want to risk disobeying Putin by not voting. "It's obvious I'm ready to suffer," he said, but he would do so only if the chief executive made his choice on the matter clear. "Only after that would I be ready to ruin what I built over 25 years," Galitsky declared. When the president and co-owner of CSKA Moscow, Yevgeny Giner, echoed his reluctance, the head of the union and Yakunin turned on him sharply, calling his views indecent. "Our country is under sanction," Yakunin told him. "Our president is standing alone on the parapet, and you're talking about screwing the country to the point they impose additional sanctions? They'll do it. No matter what you do, even if you crawl before them on your stomach, they'll do it. Understand? So either bug out of this country or behave appropriately, like a citizen of this country." 9 days later, Putin having made his wishes clear, the union's executive committee accepted the three new teams into Russia's professional league. Sergei Stepashin, Putin's predecessor as prime minister and now a member of the union's executive committee, had warned them. Directives aren't even needed. Crimea is a priori a territory of Russia. Crimea had become the new rallying cry around which the nation would unite behind Putin, the argument that ended all debate. The annexation drove his approval ratings above 85%, and the state of siege that followed, amplified by Orwellian agitprop on the state television, sustained Putin's popular support at home for months to come. After a quarter century of openness since the Soviet collapse, of economic and cultural exchange, most Russians again looked at the outside world as an enemy at the gates, to be feared and resisted. The siege mentality justified any sacrifice. "When a Russian feels any foreign pressure, he will never give up his leader," said one of Putin's deputy prime ministers, Igor Shuvalov, considered one of the liberals in his cabinet. "We will survive any hardship in the country, eat less food, use less electricity." Fear of censure, or worse, certainly silenced dissenting voices. But Putin had reasserted his place at the pinnacle of power, the indisputable leader of a country no longer a democracy except in periodic electoral simulation. After returning to power in 2012 with no clear purpose other than the exercise of power for its own sake, Putin now found the unifying factor for a large, diverse nation still in search of one. He found a millenarian purpose for the power that he held, one that shaped his country greater than any other leader had thus far in the 21st century. He had restored neither the Soviet Union nor the Tsarist Empire, but a new Russia with the characteristics and instincts of both, with himself as Secretary General and sovereign, as indispensable as the country itself was exceptional. No Putin, no Russia. He had unified the country behind the only leader anyone could now imagine because he was, as in 2008 and 2012, unwilling to allow any alternative to emerge. When he disappeared from public view for 10 days in March 2015, the political elite seemed gripped by paralysis, the media filled with fevered speculation. Was Putin ill? Was there a coup? Was he grappling with an internal power struggle stemming from Nemtsov's assassination, whose killers were traced to the Chechnya he had kept in Russia's orbit under Ramzan Kadyrov? There were new rumors that he had fathered another child with Alina Kabayeva, who by then had resigned her seat in the Duma and joined the National Media Group, controlled by Bank Rossiya and Putin's old friend Yuri Kovalchuk. Others contended he simply underwent a new round of medical treatment for a bad back, or cosmetic surgery. Whatever the explanation, his brief and ultimately inconsequential absence from public view proved that he alone provided the stability that kept the unwieldy kleptocratic system in place, the factions of Putin's elite in stable equipoise. Putin's rule was no more permanent now than it had been inevitable, yet it seemed inexorable. He faced no obvious challenge to his power before the presidential election scheduled for 2018. He could, by law, serve 6 more years after that. When, if, he stepped down in 2024, he would not yet be 72. Brezhnev had died in office at 75, Stalin at 74. He might then hand power to a new leader, Medvedev again, perhaps, or another member of the inner circle. It would ultimately be up to him. The fate of Russia was now entwined with his own, rushing forward as the Troika in Gogol's Dead Souls to an unknown destiny. Putin probably did not know himself whither, except forward, impetuous, unrepentant, undaunted. The air rumbles, shattered to pieces, and turns to wind, Gogol wrote of the Troika. Everything on earth flies by, and looking askance, other nations and states step aside to make way. This is Rene Ruiz. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin by Stephen Lee Myers. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 2015 by Stephen Lee Myers. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.